listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to today's edition of the show. Today, broadcasting our fourth episode of The Big Conversation Season 3, debating the fine-tuning of the cosmos today with two special guests who I'll introduce shortly. Summer, though, definitely arrived here in the UK over the last week or so. A little bit of rain, but that's par for the course in a UK summer. But as nature goes into full bloom, it's a summer of science that we're bringing you on Unbelievable throughout June. More on other exciting shows coming up later on in this month, a little later. But don't forget, before we launch into today's show, you can get hold of all of those digital downloads of the video sessions from Unbelievable 2021, our conference that we held back in May, all in high definition, by going to unbelievable.live. That's the place to go. And I know a lot of people have been making sure that they've got along there to get hold of all of the sessions from the conference. Later on in today's show, I'll also be bringing you the results from our audience surveys of the past two big conversations, one on AI with Nick Bostrom and Rosalind Picard, and also that one on Identity, Myth and Miracles, the live stream show with NT Wright and Douglas Murray. But as we get into today's big conversation, can I mention I'd love you to respond to the survey we've produced for today's show. There's a link with the info on the podcast. It's quick and multi-choice, and we'd love your feedback. So if you get time, please do, after you've listened to the show, click through to the survey. Tell us whether the show changed your mind in any way. And if you want more from The Big Conversation, updates, bonus content, and our regular newsletter, please do sign up at thebigconversation.show. Hello and welcome along to The Big Conversation from Unbelievable, brought to you in partnership with the John Templeton Foundation. I'm Justin Brierley, and The Big Conversation is all about exploring the biggest questions of science, faith and philosophy with some of the leading thinkers from the religious and non-religious world. Today we're talking about the fine-tuning of the universe, and was the cosmos created for us? This season is being recorded remotely for obvious reasons, but the silver lining is that it does allow us to bring fascinating voices together from around the world. And joining me today are Luke Barnes and Sabina Hossenfelder. Luke Barnes is an astrophysicist researching galaxy formation and dark energy at Western Sydney University. He's a co-author of books including A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos, and believes that fine-tuning provides evidence that life was indeed intended by a creator. Sabina Hossenfelder is a theoretical physicist researching dark matter at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies, and she's the author of Lost in Math, How Beauty Leads Physics Astray. She doesn't believe the universe is fine-tuned for life, or that God's existence can be hypothesized from science. Such a treat to have you both on the programme with me today, Sabina and Luke. Thank you for joining me. Let's start with you, Sabina. How did you get involved in this particular area of science? And tell us a little bit about your interests, because you don't only produce great videos on your YouTube channel explaining scientific concepts. You even do music videos and things. So tell us a little about yourself, first of all.
Yeah, so how did I get into this? I originally studied mathematics, and it turned out I was more interested by the question, how much can we learn from mathematics about the world, than by figuring out exactly, you know, how mathematical structures themselves behave. So naturally, I ended up being in physics, mostly in the foundations of physics, researching this question, how much can we learn about the world using mathematics? And I worked for a little bit on quantum gravity, high energy particle physics. Now I do more astrophysics, as you just said. I also do a little bit foundations of quantum mechanics. So all that kind of stuff where mathematics is really the whole game, basically. I have a lot of interest related to this. I have an interest in the philosophy of physics. It's kind of very close by this whole research area. And as you said, I guess I have a creative urge. So every once in a while I sing.
It's fun. I've really enjoyed watching some of your videos. What about faith, Sabina? Has belief in God or any kind of faith ever figured in your life or not really?
Well, so I've grown up in Germany, and most people here are a Christian, either a Roman Catholic or a Protestant. My husband's whole family is Catholic. But I've grown up, an atheist, I've also never been Christianized. And, I considered attending church. I attended mass for some time and I liked the singing, but I couldn't really identify with it. So, I would say that, for what my profession as a scientist is concerned, I would identify as agnostic. I don't really have an opinion about it either way. But if you ask about the way that I live my life in practice, I don't belong to any religion. I don't attend church.
Sure. When you look at the night sky or some of the extraordinary things about our universe, does it ever inspire anything like religious awe in you, or would you describe it a different way?
I would say I don't really know what you're talking about. So I guess that means the answer is no. I mean, I find it totally amazing. You know, I like to think about what's going on out there, and it always still blows my mind. You know, if you try to imagine the size of the cosmos and all the stuff that's in there, but I don't associate anything religious with it.
Okay, well, maybe we'll return to some of those sorts of questions later on in the show. But I'm really looking forward to unpacking some of the science behind this as well. And with Luke, of course, our other guest on the show today. Luke, bit of background to yourself. How did you end up researching dark matter and multiverses and all the interesting stuff you do? And of course, the fine tuning of the universe for life. How did you come into that particular field?
Well, I started off as a more respectable astrophysicist, just doing things like how galaxies form. Cosmology was always an interest. I mean, I grew up as a bit of a dinosaur nerd, but again, through maths, just wanted to realize this was a way to understand the world. But I had heard about this sort of field of fine-tuning, books by Barrow and Tipler and Paul Davis and a bunch of other people, and so just started reading the scientific literature on this and got fascinated in it, and then sort of realized there were ways to contribute to that field by looking at various ways that life depends on the fundamental constants of nature.
Brilliant. Tell me about your own faith commitments. I mean, and do they at any level sort of impact the science that you do?
So I'm a Christian. I grew up in a Christian household, and sort of towards the end of teenage years, obviously an interest in science. There's a whole lot of people who, you know, were saying that, you know, these two things couldn't be held together. So I started reading a whole bunch of stuff by atheists. There's a whole bunch of Dawkins behind me and such. And at the end of that, still had my faith. I still go to church and all those sorts of things. It inspires me to investigate the world, because the world's an amazing place, and for me, an amazing creation. So, but beyond that, apart from a very deep belief that the universe is ultimately a rational place, beyond that, science and science is really just sort of the world. My Christian faith is really the worldview in which I do science, rather than anything that specifically turns up in a theory. I never answered God on any of my physics exams.
Well, it's great to have you both on the show today. Thank you very much for joining me. Maybe we should start with an explanation of the fine tuning of the universe itself. Obviously, we're going to try and keep this accessible for lay people. Luke, in a way, you're making the argument for this phenomenon today. So why don't you begin and explain as simply as you can what the fine tuning of the universe for life is, and maybe with an example or two of some of these particular constants and parameters that appear to be finely tuned for life to develop in the cosmos.
Right. So roughly, when we say fine-tuned, it's a bit like the way we use it in everyday life. It doesn't necessarily mean a fine-tuner. It just means that there's some sort of, that an explanation requires a suspiciously precise assumption in order to work. And so specifically, when we look at the ultimate, sort of the deepest laws of nature we currently have, the standard models, there are these numbers in them, and for whatever reason, mischievousness or curiosity, we can think about what would happen if those numbers were different. What would happen if you know, there was a universe, and when you describe these universe in laws, there was the same laws as ours, but these numbers were different. And there's numbers like the cosmological constant, which is a sort of an accelerating influence on space, or a decelerating influence on space, to put it roughly. There's a sort of range that this number could have in our theories between what are called the Planck limits. Of if we wanted to go outside of those limits, we need a quantum theory of gravity, and we don't really have a successful one of those at the moment. But within those limits, almost all of the universes are kind of disastrous. So if the number is too large and positive, the universe expands so fast that no structure forms, no protons ever sort of get together into nuclei or anything. If it's too negative, then the universe recollapses in less than a second or something. And within the total range, the limits that avoid those two sort of catastrophes is sort of one part in about, even very conservatively, 10 to the 90 at most. We can also talk about the sort of typical scale of the particles, of the masses of the particles we're made of. There's a number called the Higgs vacuum expectation value. It has a certain value in our universe. It could, in the equations, go between zero and, again, this Planck limit. And on that scale, you've got to land between, the numbers are 6 times 10 to the minus 18 and about 3 times 10 to the minus 17. So, you know, 6 times 1 over and then 18 zeros on the bottom there. These are the sort of numbers. And if you're on one side of that range, then a free hydrogen atom can just eat its electron and turn into a neutron. So you get a pure neutron universe in which structure won't form. And if you're on the other side, then you can't stick any of the fundamental bits of the universe together to make nuclei. And again, you get a pretty disastrous kind of boring universe. There's also the strengths of the forces. The fine structure constant, for example, it in our universe is about 7/1,000. If it was 18/1,000, then you'd get the neutron universe again. The proton would be heavier than the neutron. It would decay into the neutron. You wouldn't get, you know, free hydrogen in the universe. And so these seem like pretty disastrous things, outcomes. And in particular, it seems like the complexity that any conceivable form of life would need would not exist in those universes. Those universes are remarkably simple. And so, you know, there's a whole bunch of other cases, just to plug the book. there's a whole bunch of them in here. The first author is Geraint Lewis, a colleague of mine at the University of Sydney, who's also an atheist. So we agree about the science, and then in the last chapter, we disagree about what it means.
Okay.
But certainly, that's some example.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And the point being here that if these, you know, particular values and constants differed even by a tiny, tiny fraction from their actual given value, we would not have a universe that could support life. Now, that's not to say that life would necessarily develop in such a universe, but you wouldn't have, for example, just the basic chemistry needed to enable life at some point to get going in the universe. That's the way I understand it, Luke.
Yeah, roughly. It's not that if we think about all the possibilities, it's not that our point is uniquely able to support life. It's just that the bits that are able to support the complexity needed by life are very small pieces of the total. So there might be another small bits elsewhere, but they're not. You don't hit them at random. But that's sort of assuming the result. But yeah, they're a very small part of the overall.
Thank you very much. Okay, Sabina, let's come to you because you've, I know, interacted with this argument before, and you're sceptical from the very outset that there really is such a thing as the fine-tuning of the universe. So tell us where you begin with all of this.
Well, it starts with what Luke said at the very beginning, that these types of fine-tuning arguments are similar to the types of fine-tuning that we observe in everyday life. They're just not. So the typical example that people like to bring up for fine-tuning is a pencil balanced on its tip. So we wouldn't normally observe that in everyday life. It's a highly unstable situation. If we saw something like that, we would expect an explanation. You know, there's something holding that pen in position, whatever. So the point is that we come to this conclusion. It's unlikely it requires an explanation, right? But how do we know that? Well, we know that there are other positions that a pencil can be in that are much more likely. And the reason we say it's much more likely is because we have observed it many times. So we have observational evidence. Now, when we're talking about the values of the constants in the concordance model or the Stern model of particle physics or whatever it is, like these examples that Luke was just talking about, we can't change these constants. They have one value for all we currently know. You know, that there are variations of these models where people consider that the constants may actually vary with space and time, but that's a different story entirely. So for the models that Luke was just talking about, they are constants, as the name says, and we can't change them. There's no physical process that will change these constants. Now, one can make a purely theoretical observation of the type that Luke was talking about, you know, as a hypothetical question. You can say, well, what would a universe look like if I were to change this constant this way or some other way? And lots of people have done that, and there have been books written about it, and that's all fine with me. But it's not a scientific claim to say there's something in need of an explanation here, because these are not examples that we can ever observe. So we don't know anything about the probability of that ever happening.
Okay, so essentially you're just not convinced that we could know that these constants and values could take a different value, and therefore we don't know what the probability is of them taking a different value. Therefore, all we have is the one example we do have in our universe of the values they do take, which do happen to support life in the universe. I know that you're very critical, not just of those who use fine tuning as an argument for God, but even for a multiverse, which is a relatively popular, as I see it, principle in physics. A lot of people seem to be, you know, engaging with that idea. But you're quite critical of that, aren't you?
Well, the multiverse is not a principle. It's a hypothesis, and it's not a scientific hypothesis. Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit more complicated. The fine-tuning argument is not the only argument that people bring up in favor of the multiverse, but it's certainly one of them. And yeah, it's kind of similar. So people are saying, well, we do observe these constants of nature. That's arguably correct. And then they say, well, we want to have an explanation for that. Like, why do the values have the values that they have? And that's fine with me. You know, that's what science is all about. You want an explanation. Then they say, well, the multiverse is this explanation. And that's there where my problem begins, because it doesn't explain anything. In the scientific sense, it doesn't explain anything. And why do they think it explains something is because they've constructed a problem which is unscientific to begin with, which is this fine-tuning argument. There's just, as you summarize it correctly, we can't change these constants, therefore we don't know anything about the probability of that ever happening, so there's nothing in need of an explanation.
Okay, I think this will be a key difference between you here then, Luke. What's your response to this idea that, well, we don't know that they could take a different value, therefore we just can't assign any probability to their being unusual in that sense?
Yeah, so the idea that the only way that you get probabilities or that you can know probabilities is by observing a large number of things, you know, data, that's an interpretation of probabilities known as frequentism, which is Sabina's outline in one of her videos. And I don't think it's an interpretation of probability that a lot of scientists subscribe to. The alternative is something called, well, there's a number of alternatives, but one of them is called Bayesianism. And I did a quick check on the NASA publication database. There are currently over 11,000 papers with the word Bayesian in the title. There are 79 papers with the word frequentist in the title, or frequentism, and half of those also have the word Bayesian in the title. So the whole point of let me try and lay out what this word means. For a Bayesian, you can interpret probabilities to mean degrees of support the idea that one statement supports another statement. So there are dark clouds overhead supports the statement that it will be raining 10 minutes from now. Now, you can also support that with data, of course, but it's not that that statement is a, you know, that statement is not a statement about the data we've already observed. It's a statement about how different propositions support each other. And once you've done that, I mean, the fact that you can't run the fine-tuning argument on frequentism is, of course. Like every paper on the fine-tuning argument, mentions that at some point. It's all run via these sort of Bayesian or epistemic probabilities, and they are widely used in physics. So there's a major statement there that needs to be supported. I mean, there's discussions of Bayesianism that Sabina's brought up in her various publications. But all I'd want to say is that to say that we can't observe other values of the constants, therefore there's no sense in talking about their probability, assumes an interpretation of probability that is not shared, that at the very least, there's a vast, vast number of scientists, of physicists, of statisticians who wouldn't sign up to that. It's called finite frequentism. And I think it's a complete non-starter.
Sabina.
Well, yes, of course, I'm aware that there are different ways of interpreting probabilities. I actually, when I made this argument, I did not say that we need to have the only way to speak about the probabilities is to have observational evidence of these other values. There are certainly other ways that you can go about it, but in the end, they all go back to evidence. Like if I think of this balanced pencil again, you don't necessarily need to sample a lot of instances of pencils in one or the other orientation. You can also just use a physical theory about what you have learned about, you know, the air or the surface that it's standing on and the kind of vibrations, distortions that can occur, and you would again come to the conclusion that it's very unlikely to observe a pencil balance on its tip, and you can interpret this in a Bayesian way. It's like it's not the expectation you would have on that observation. But again, that's an argument you can't make for the constants of nature. There are no physical processes that could change these constants of nature because they're constant. And if you go by the expectation that we have from the observations that we have made, your expectation is, of course, the next time you measure, you know, alpha, it will have the same value that it had before. So again, I don't know what you're talking about,
Luke. I mean, is there any in principle reason why you couldn't, these values couldn't take a difference? I mean, are you saying that yes, of course they do take the value they take in our universe, but you don't see any reason why they couldn't potentially be different from the values they do hold?
Yeah, so maybe it'll help if we just sort of step back a bit. This is all happening in the context of some very fundamental questions about the universe. So if we're talking about the fine-tuning argument, I take the fine-tuning argument to be a sort of an extension of a very basic, it's not even an argument, it's just kind of an instinct. You know, why do most people who've ever lived and still live believe that there's a God? Well, one of the reasons might be if you look around at the universe and there are various bits and pieces of it that seem to fit well together in a way that you might think, you know, needs a mind. And that's a very sort of basic way of putting the world together and seeing if that makes sense of it. And it seems that it does make sense of it. There's various things around us that seem like that. So the question is now, what happens when science starts to inform the way that we actually understand the world? Well, on a first level, finding that the world is more intricately put together than our first observations show seems to strengthen that intuition. If you think a hummingbird is amazing, then zooming out and seeing the whole of an ecosystem, or looking back in time at the processes that brought the hummingbird into existence, or zooming in on the sort of the biological details of a hummingbird, all of that is just more amazing stuff. And so if you want to try and make this sort of instinct really secure, you might say, okay, let's go as deep as we can and try to work out whether the universe that we see is the sort of place that looks kind of thrown together at random, you know, Bertrand Russell saying we're all accidental collocations of atoms, or whether there is something remarkable about the way the universe is at its most fundamental level. And what fine-tuning suggests is there's a systematic way of doing this. Why don't we go to the fundamental laws of nature, and when we look at those, there are these numbers that you just have to put in that the equation doesn't give you. Why don't we systematically change those as much as we can and try and work out what would happen and see if there is something remarkable about the way the universe is, as opposed to ways the universe could have been. So the fact that there aren't, that's a counterfactual statement, other things, the way the universe could have been. So I think in that context, what fine-tuning is trying to do, it's trying to answer that question, is there anything remarkable about the way the universe is rather than the ways that it could have been but isn't? And a systematic way of looking through those is let's change these constants. And when you do that, these other possibilities are just kind of, as best we know, possibilities. I mean, if you've got some idea about why it's metaphysically necessary or logically necessary, why the universe has to be like this, then publish it. But in the absence of that, let's at least look at these other possibilities, see if there's something remarkable about our universe. And into that, what the Bayesian approach is giving is to say that we can take our uncertainty about why things are the way they are, and that is enough to generate a probability distribution. Yes, I can get them from data, frequentism. I can get them from scientific models. That's objective chances. There's various ways of that. That's another interpretation of probability. Yes, I can get them that way. I can also get them from uncertainty. I mean, this is what probabilities are supposed to do. The fact that there is uncertainty in if I just sort of look at the world, trying to look at it blankly and say, okay, what are some other ways it could have been? And I don't know why it's this way rather than another way. That uncertainty under certain conditions can be quantified into a probability.
We'll get your response to that in a moment's time, Sabina. I'm just going to go to a quick break, and then I'd love to open up this question of whether you do think it's remarkable in any case that the universe does happen to take the values it takes, or whether, you know, the fact that we're here to observe it, you know, just is, you know, one of those things. It couldn't be other than it is. We're talking about the fine-tuning of the universe today here on The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and joined today by Luke Barnes and Sabina Hossenfelder.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to this week's edition of The Big Conversation from Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. My guests today are Luke Barnes and Sabina Hossenfelder. We're talking about the fine-tuning of the universe. Was the cosmos made for us? And just in that last section, Sabina, we heard Luke describing the ways in which he believes it is valid to look at the constants and values of the fundamental forces in the universe, and to see that there is they do require an explanation for why they take the value they take that involves us. I mean, a common response to this has been something sometimes called the weak anthropic principle, as an objection to this, which is that, well, look, it's hardly surprising that we observe a universe which has the kinds of qualities that can sustain us, because we wouldn't be here to observe it otherwise. It's a kind of, well, what else would you expect to see? I mean, do you find that a sufficient sort of explanation for why we find ourselves in this universe, that of course it's going to have the values that support us, Sabina?
Well, that depends very much on what you mean by sufficient explanation. Now, the anthropic principle, I think, has been a little bit abused by some people. To me, it's just, it's an observational constraint on our parameters. I don't know what's different about the observation that we exist, like we're here and we're talking. That seems like a true observation. And that's only possible if the constants of nature are within certain parameter ranges that allow for the existence of life. And that's just correct. Now, when one can debate how useful this constraint is in practice, I would say it has limited use, but there's nothing unscientific about it. Now, does that explain the values of the constants per se? Not. It explains certain constraints on them, as I just said. But to come to your question, like, is there something in need of an explanation? Well, when it comes to purely the values of these constants, taking into account the observational constraints that we have, the answer is no. Now, then you can ask, are the theories that we have right now, are they a satisfactory explanation? Are they a sufficient explanation? And I think that's just a very, you know, a very personal question. Some people would say, well, the theories that we have are sufficient. They're fine as an explanation. And other people might go and ask for some kind of a deeper explanation, maybe. And I would just say, well, that's leaving the scientific territory.
And in that sense, then, when you kind of look at your existence in the universe, you don't think this is highly unlikely or remarkable. You just take it as a given that the universe has produced you.
That's right. I don't think this is unlikely, because I have no way to say anything about this probability.
Okay. Luke, what's your response to this particular way of saying, yeah, there isn't an issue to be debated here, because what else would you be expecting? You know, you're looking at a universe that produced you. It's bound to have the kinds of fundamental physics that allows that.
Well, I think Sabina's point is slightly different from the anthropic principle. Her video on this is quite good, actually, which is refreshing. There's a whole lot of nonsense about the anthropic principle going around. The crucial point there was that the values of these constants are not calling out for an explanation. And so I think there is a general case to say that they are. So if you take, say, Popper's account of what's a good criterion, say a necessary, maybe sufficient, depends who you ask, criterion for an idea to be a scientific idea. Well, it's got to be falsifiable. There's got to be some set of observations that we could make where we'd say, all right, well, we saw this, and so that idea is definitely wrong. One of the ways to avoid being falsified is to make your idea very flexible. And so if you make an idea very flexible so that it can explain a whole range of things, depending on its own internal, you know, cogs and wheels, the problem is it won't explain the data, it will simply accommodate the data. Now, free parameters in any theory are assumptions. Those are flexibility in the theory. The standard model of particle physics has 25 of them. Okay, so those in and of themselves are flexibility in the theory. And if we could get behind that to a theory that removes some of that flexibility, that would be a better thing. And I don't think there's much disagreement with Sabina, what you would not accept is if someone said, I've got a better theory that explains the value of the constant, someone saying, oh no, I can just say that the constant is what it is and there's nothing to explain. If there's nothing to explain, then how can there be a better explanation? That's my confusion with Sabina's position here.
Go ahead, Sabina.
So the theories that we presently use work just fine. I think we agree on that. So they definitely explain a huge lot of data, both out there in the cosmos and when it comes to particle physics. And I yet have to see a better theory. Let me put it that way. So these theories are de facto the best explanations that we currently have. Is it possible that there are better explanations than that, from which we can maybe one day calculate several of these constants, or they turn out to be related in some way? Certainly, you know, I don't have an issue with that. But there's nothing right now from which I would say that actually requires such an explanation. For all we presently know, these constants may just have the values that they have, period. And that's it. And that's just the best explanation that there is.
Yeah. Why does that explanation not satisfy you then, Luke? I'm trying to get to the core of why you think that we do need a better explanation than just these are the constants we have and that's enough.
Yeah. Again, how do I want to put this? I get back to Popper's point about flexible theories. So think about a sort of a mathematician and they lay out the axioms of here's where I'm going to start from and then I'm going to try and prove some stuff. If someone could come along and say, okay, see your starting point. Hey, I could take one of those off this list, that list, and still prove everything that you've proved. We would go with that second simpler option. So part of what makes a better explanation is that it has fewer assumptions. Now, just counting assumptions is a bit of a rough idea. What we want to be actually more precise about that, and I think the Bayesian approach gives us that precision. So what I want to say is that a free parameter in a theory is a degree of flexibility that a deeper theory might not have, and in that case, the deeper theory would win. So wherever you've got one of these constants, you've got a sort of opportunity there. There's a wonderful quote from Richard Feynman basically saying every physicist should put the fine structure constant 1 over 137, roughly, up on their wall and worry about it. And this was his point. It's an assumption. And if we could do better and not have to make an assumption and still explain all the data, that would be great. The way this comes back around to the fine-tuning argument is not that I'm ruling out deeper theories, not that I think that God is going to be the deeper explanation of that. No, we keep doing science, right? I'm a scientist. I'm not saying we stop science now and we all go to church. The point of the fine-tuning argument is if we're trying to look around at other ways the universe could have been, this fact about the deepest laws that we know now tells us that there is something remarkable about this universe all the way down to the bottom. Your amazement at seeing a hummingbird goes all the way down. You should be amazed at the values of the fundamental constants of nature for the same sorts of reasons.
I mean, coming back to you, Sabina, I mean, one of the earliest people to sort of make a comment on this phenomenon of fine tuning was Fred Hoyle, you know, well-known British physicist, and he discovered, he predicted a certain resonance, and you'll have to tell me the scientific aspect of this to get this right, in carbon, which would make sense of us being able to be here, of life being able to exist in the universe. Now, his famous phrase on that was that, to all intents and purposes, it looks like something or someone has monkeyed with physics and there are no blind forces worth speaking of in nature. He obviously felt that there was something that needed an explanation here. Could you first of all explain what Fred Hoyle was describing there, what he had discovered and why he thought it made it look as though, though he didn't necessarily follow it to Luke's conclusions, obviously, but why it made it look as though there was this fine tuning going on. Give us the specific example from the science, first of all.
Well, yeah, goodness, you're putting me on the spot there. So I can't recall exactly how this argument goes, but it's roughly speaking something of the type that for nuclear fusion to continue in stars the way that we observe it, there needs to be specific structure about the carbon nucleus and which was not known at the time, but Hoyle said it has to be there, otherwise it doesn't work. And it was later actually observed. So this prediction turned out to be correct. So Luke, please correct me if I got this entirely wrong. I think that's good. As I can remember. And so I would say that that's an example of using the weak anthropic principle. You know, he made this observation like stars burn, we are here. There has to be something in this nuclear fusion cycle that allows for this. And that led him, to this conclusion. That's a fine scientific argument. Now, as for, his feeling that there's something in need of being explaining or that Luke says there's something remarkable here that requires an explanation, I don't know what to do with these statements. You know, they're not scientific statements. I don't think they're warranted from a scientific perspective. Now, you know, if people feel that way, that's certainly fine with me. But from a purely observational point of view, I don't think we have any reason why there has to be this deeper explanation. And let me say again, you know, I would be super excited if there was one. Like, you know, if someone comes up tomorrow and says, yeah, look, I can calculate all 26 parameters or something of the standard model, using a much simpler equation. You know, I would be super excited because I would be convinced that there will certainly be more insights falling out of this. But for all we currently know, it just doesn't have to be the case.
I guess I'm interested in teasing out this particular example, Luke, because I often think it helps to have a sort of specific example in front of us. But this idea that Hoyle predicted that the I think it's something like the resonance of the carbon atom or something would have to take a very, very specific value in order to allow the fusion that would obviously enable us to exist as carbon-based creatures and so on. He felt there was something curious that needed explaining at the heart of that, though, as I say, he didn't end up becoming a theist or anything like that. Explain that example to us and what your why you believe those kinds of examples do require an explanation beyond themselves, in a sense.
Well, I can't do much better explaining the physics than Sabina without, you know, doing a whole lot of maths. But the basic idea is there. You're trying to smash two things together to make three things, in fact, together to make carbon. Given the physics known to Hoyle at the time, it simply wasn't going to work in large stars unless there was a bit of physics missing. This way that carbon can wobble around, you know, oscillate, and resonate, in a certain way. So why is this so? The reason I think why this affected Hoyle was just that basically the thought, you know, as follows. There's a wonderful quote from Dawkins, I think it must be behind me somewhere, where he basically says, you know, however many ways there are to be alive, it is certain that there are vastly more ways to be dead, or rather not alive. And he takes the example of if you take 2 grams of matter and you arrange it, most of those arrangements won't fly or reproduce or do anything like that. So there's this thought of, you know, what do you expect if there's no deeper explanation of the world we see around us? Is that you wouldn't expect there to be any sort of unlikely, there's that word again, sort of remarkable, interesting, you know, conspiracies that have to come together in order for us to exist. We just have to be, as Russell said, accidental collocations of atoms. So to find that our existence depends on what seems like a very unlikely thing to turn up in a carbon atom, that overturns some of the way that Hoyle thought about the world. I should say, and I have to put in this is the sort of asterisk that basically me and about 4 other people care about. Fred Adams has done some interesting work in looking at exactly how fine-tuned this case is. There's a sort of back way around that. You can, for the experts, you can bind beryllium is another way of getting, anyway, it's not quite as fine-tuned as Hoyle thought it was, but there still are good examples of fine-tuning. Let me put that asterisk.
Well, we could talk about other examples, obviously, that maybe have a firmer foundation in that sense. I suppose where this leads me all, as a layperson here, Sabina, I understand where you're coming from, I think, the idea that, look, we don't know if these values and the laws of physics could have taken different forms and so on. Therefore, it's a pointless question to be asking. But I still get left with that nagging question of why a universe that produces us, that can produce life, it still seems like even if the laws somehow, there was some mechanism that meant that all the physical parameters had to take the value they take, it still seems remarkable that they took those values and produced us. It just seems like, to me at least, it still feels like it needs an explanation. it's like, what's the principle that caused all of the laws to take the exact values that there were, even if they couldn't have been different from they were, it still feels like we still need to understand why they've taken that value. Does that make sense? It's otherwise you're just sort of saying it's a brute fact almost that they take the value they take, as though that doesn't need explaining. Does that make sense to you, Sabina?
Well, as I've said a few times, what you think needs explaining is not necessarily a scientific question. I would say from the scientific perspective, it does not currently need explaining. You know, the universe has to be some way, and it's the way that we observe. That's just a fact. And I think that the task of science is to come up with the best explanations for these observations as well as we can do. And I mean explanation here in, especially in physics, in a purely quantitative way. You know, we have these theories and they come with some parameters, but of course the parameters are not the only assumptions. There are lots of other assumptions that also go into these theories. I don't know, space-time is a 3+1 dimensional Riemannian manifold with a differentiable structure and so on and so forth, all that kind of stuff. And we use these theories to calculate observations, you know, the measurement results for our observations. And we do as best as we can. And for me, that's what science is all about. And as I've said a few times, you can certainly wish there is an underlying theory, and maybe there is one, but maybe there just isn't one. You know, maybe that's just the best that we can do.
Do you think the question, why is there even a universe? Why is there a set of physical laws that take the value they do? Is that not a science question? Is that not a question that you're in a position to be asking? Is it a question that another person could ask, a philosopher, a theologian? I mean, I suppose I'm coming to sort of to that really metaphysical point of saying science obviously looks at the physical universe, and we can make hypotheses and look at the data and make predictions and so on. But the question of why is there a universe with physical laws, and does that itself need an explanation? You feel that goes beyond the purview of science, in your view?
Yes, actually. So I wouldn't even know how to formally phrase the question that you just posed. But even the question that Luke's puts forward, like about the fine tuning, I would already say that this is not a scientific question. It's just not a question that we know how to address with science. And you can certainly ask for an explanation, but it won't be a scientific explanation. So my issue with this whole fine-tuning argument, and by the way, this isn't only something that comes up in cosmology and astrophysics. Particle physicists also use very similar arguments, though they phrase them a little bit differently. So it's not exactly the same story, but a very, very similar ones. That's just a conflation between scientific reasoning and, you can call it philosophical reasoning or maybe religious reasoning, depending on what side you're on.
Sure. Luke, what do you think? It's a legitimate scientific question to ask, where do the laws come from? Where does the universe come from? To kind of, I suppose, go beyond the basic fact of physical reality to ask, does physical reality need an explanation?
Well, let me shock the audience and say no. It's a philosophical question. It's not a scientific question. I totally agree with that. If you think that the only good questions are scientific questions, then you'll think that these aren't good questions. I'd want to know why you think that. And the problem is, if you think you have a good answer to the question, why are all good questions scientific questions? That's going to be a philosophical answer, because it's a philosophical question. Anyway, the point I make, so I don't want to replace science with God, right? This is not the point. We'll keep doing science, because of course we will. I will. I want to know how this whole place works. The point of this is, I think the way I'd want to phrase this, I don't actually like the phrase demands an explanation or needs an explanation. I think it's what matters is the possibility of a better explanation. That's all we have. And an explanation with fewer assumptions is a better explanation. The constants are assumptions, and so off we go. In terms of the fine-tuning argument, what we're trying to think of is you know, imagine this is it. And actually, for most people don't. I think most physicists would not accept that. That, you know, maybe this is just the way the universe is. That would be highly unlikely. But whatever. Suppose this universe is the way it is. Are there any deeper questions we still want to understand? And I think you've got two options here. You have a whole bunch of questions like, why is there a universe at all? Why is the universe the way it is rather than some other way? Why does the universe obey scientific laws at all rather than just being a collection of events with no patterns at all? Why is there a universe in which life can exist when we have so many examples of universes where it couldn't? What do we do with those questions? And they're not scientific questions because science can't answer them. What do we do with them? We either say science is it, we throw them out, we try and, you could call that naturalism. Sean Carroll calls that naturalism. I think that's his book right there. You either say these are not the questions we could ever get an answer to. We certainly can't get a scientific answer, and so we can't get any answer. Or, you know, whatever reason you have for that. Or the other option is let's look at the sort of things that might be able to explain it. And the theistic answer is the fine-tuning argument tries to say that there is the possibility of a better explanation. Whether it cries out for explanation, I think, is an unhelpful phrase, actually. But there's the possibility of not just saying this is the way it is, but it's the way it is for a certain reason. And if that can actually do some explanatory work for us, perhaps not in terms of calculation, but in terms of rendering something that we know to be true to be more likely than it would otherwise be, because probabilities change as a function of the hypothesis that you're assuming. That's an important point. Then we've got a reason there to think that those deeper questions have answers.
Is that something that interests you, Sabina, these deeper questions? I mean, there is a sort of boundary point at which you can come to conclusions scientifically. Do you feel compelled in any way to go beyond that and to start asking those deeper philosophical questions about why there is a universe, whether the laws of nature are ultimately everything that exists, or actually whether they too need an explanation and so on?
If you ask me personally, no, it's just not what I want to do with my life. It doesn't interest me very much. my shtick is more to try to tell physicists when they cross the border from science to philosophy or religion. And, you know, if Luke says, that's not a scientific question, it's a philosophical question, he still wants an answer. These questions should be asked. People should try to answer them, maybe by using different modes of explanation. That's all fine with me. I just don't want this to be conflated with scientific explanations, because I'm very concerned, and that's what my whole book is about, that this leads scientists into a dead end, basically, where they're trying to solve problems that don't exist. And that's pretty much what has happened in particle physics.
I mean, just elaborate on that just a little bit, Sabina, because your book, as I mentioned, it's called Lost in Math: How Beauty Leads Physics Astray. You think that there's been too much of an emphasis on this idea of finding the beautiful solution, you know, the something that looks wonderful. You think physics is just more messy than that, and are too many physicists being led astray into a kind of metaphysical kind of sense of there has to be some underlying structure, you know, that goes beyond just the physics of the universe?
Well, the problem is that they are making metaphysical arguments, but don't know it. They're not aware of what they're doing. So they're confusing the science with the philosophy. So in particle physics, and you will notice this if you read the book, because I've interviewed quite a few people They think these are just mathematical arguments, and they don't realize that there's actually quite a bit of metaphysics behind believing that this is something that even requires an explanation. And at least for particle physics, it has not worked. It just hasn't worked. They've tried to use these arguments over and over again. And it's a very similar story to the, as I said, to the fine-tuning cosmology, though with a slightly different twist for exactly what you're varying over and so on. I don't really want to go into this. There too, the argument is basically, well, you know, there's some kind of constant that requires an explanation. And then we've come up with an explanation for that. You know, there's this new particle or I don't know, new field, or we need supersymmetry and additional symmetry unification, all that kind of stuff. And these hypotheses turned out to be wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong and wrong. It's just been a dramatically unsuccessful strategy. And the point that I'm trying to get across, well, that's because you didn't ask a scientific question in the first place. And so this is why, you know, I don't want to stop people from asking these questions. That's all fine with me. I want them to be aware that this is not a scientific strategy. It's not a scientific methodology.
I'll come back to you for some comments on that in a moment's time, Luke. We're heading into our final break. We're talking about the fine-tuning of the universe. Was the cosmos made for us on the big conversation from Unbelievable today? I'm Justin Brierley. My guests are Luke Barnes and Sabina Hossenfelder. Hello and welcome back to the third and final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Our big conversation featuring Sabina Hossenfelder and Luke Barnes, returning to their conversation very shortly. If you're able to stick around a little bit later on this evening here on Premier Christian Radio, Gareth and Ali Gilkerson of The Rend Collective are talking to Sam Hales about their unique brand of folk-inspired worship and their global music ministry. That's also available as a podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You're looking for The Profile from Premier. And next week here on Unbelievable, it's a bit of a science fest throughout June. I'm calling this the Summer of Science on Unbelievable. Today it's fine-tuning, but next week it's going to be the origins of the universe and the case for God. Well-known intelligent design advocate Stephen C. Meyer has a new book out called The Return of the God Hypothesis. He'll be in conversation with University of California physics professor Brian Keating. And then we've got further shows debating intelligent design in biology. Gunter Beckley and Joshua Swamidas are joining me. And another fantastic big conversation too on the origins of life. That one is between Paul Davis and Jeremy England. So lots of science this summer on Unbelievable to look forward to. I'd love you, by the way, to respond to today's show. We've got a survey and there's a link with the info on today's podcast. It's quick, multi-choice. Would love your feedback about whether today's show has changed your mind in any way, wherever you're coming from, atheist, Christian, some other worldview, on the issue of fine-tuning in the cosmos. And if you want more from The Big Conversation, updates, bonus content, our regular newsletter, please do sign up at thebigconversation.show. And if you go there, you can watch the YouTube video of today's show as well. Let's leap back into the conversation between Luke and Sabina.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Such an interesting conversation on the fine-tuning of the cosmos today on The Big Conversation. Sabina Hossenfelder is a theoretical physicist researching dark matter at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies and author of Lost in Math, How Beauty Leads Physics Astray. I'll make sure there are links to Sabina and her very popular YouTube channel as well with today's show. Also to Luke Barnes, who's our Christian guest on the show. He's an astrophysicist researching things like galaxy formation, dark energy, and fine-tuning of the universe for life. His book on this particular subject is A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos. Though the more recent book is just behind you on your video camera, Luke. It's
strategic.
Just to give us the title of that and a very brief explanation of what you're doing in that new book.
It's called The Cosmic Revolutionary's Handbook, or How to Beat the Big Bang. And so I'm sure Sabina's got some great stories about this as well. Ask any physicist, cosmologist, you get emails with people who say, I've got the final theory of everything. Here it is. And all we wanted to do was just say, all right, if you want to do that, here's how to do it properly. For starters, here's the data that you haven't bothered looking up to, you know, to actually explain. And here's why we do things like peer review and publishing and those sorts of things. So it's a tour of the universe under the guise of here are the most important facts that led us to the way we think the universe is. And if you want to do better, here's how to do it.
Fantastic. I'll make sure there's links as well to you as well, Luke. I mean, in that last segment, we sort of heard Sabina again saying she thinks too many scientists are ending up asking unscientific questions, questions that are more metaphysical, that are more about finding some kind of purported beauty in the equations and in the underlying structure and so on. Is the same true? Could the same be argued for the fine-tuning sort of arguments that you're making? You're attempting to ask basically an unscientific question about some scientific parameters, essentially.
Well, the reason I sort of said before that these are not scientific questions is because of what they're about. I mean, these are not theories about how the universe work. And so, you know, by stipulation, then they're not scientific theories. But I want to make I think there's something needs to be clarified here. There's the fine-tuning argument. And I said that wasn't scientific just because of what it's trying to explain things in terms of. God is not a physical thing. The idea of God is not the idea of a physical thing, and so it can't be a scientific theory. But I don't actually think that fine-tuning as it's applied in physics is necessarily a philosophical belief. I think starting from the sort of Bayesian framework, there has to be a way of saying, all right, I've got two theories, which one is the best? And one way of thinking about that is which one makes the most assumptions to, you know, if you're just counting assumptions, or the most implausible assumption, or which, you know, has the most internal flexibility. And I think that the Bayesian approach has the best way of doing that. And that is a scientific question because we're trying to appraise scientific theories. However, I don't want to say I'm an astrophysicist. I don't want to say that everything that particle physicists have done in applying a fine-tuning or a related idea called naturalness is fine. So actually, a lot of Sabina's critiques of that I can be on board with. And in particular, this matters because we're building billion-dollar machines to try and test these ideas is a very good reason to think very hard about what we think we're doing. So I wouldn't go as far as saying that they're purely philosophical, but I don't want to just endorse them either. There are ways to do that sort of reasoning wrong.
And when it comes to how you kind of move from the fine tuning to the belief in a creator God, now, as you've said yourself, you're not saying God is the outcome of this. Is it more that are you doing a philosophical journey there of saying, well, given this phenomenon of fine tuning, which you did believe, obviously, against Sabina, is a valid sort of idea, phenomenon, but given that, does it fit better with the view that there is potentially a creator behind the universe, or that we're living in a naturalistic universe, that all that exists is the physical stuff of the universe? Is it simply that you're saying if you had to choose between the two options, you think it's more consistent with the idea of a God?
Yeah, so I've tried to understand what the naturalists say when they say, you know, Sean Carroll, Sabina saying these questions. Feel free to ask them, but there's nothing we can do to know whether any answer to them is better than any other answer. I do think we can do better than that, which is what fine-tuning is doing. These are metaphysical questions. These are philosophical questions, but I don't think that means that we're not allowed to ask them, or that we shouldn't ask them, or that we can just go, you know, this is the way the universe is, deal with it. I think it's a basic principle, not just of science, but of rationality, to try and put together your worldview in a way that explains the most with the least assumptions. And I think what fine tuning shows is that just assuming that our universe is going to be life permitting, if you want to put it that way, is a big assumption. Or to put it another way, there is something remarkable and rare about the way that our universe is, in that it permits life.
Yeah. I mean, again, I can kind of predict where you're going to go with this, Sabina, I suppose, but asking that kind of that next level question, I mean, you've said at the beginning you're kind of, I think, did you describe yourself as essentially atheist or agnostic? Does that impact the way you approach, if you like, the outcomes of your science? Do you think, in a sense, that you're going to assume that there's nothing else going on beyond the physical science because you haven't been given any reason to believe in God? Is that fair to say?
I really don't think that it matters at all for my research. Just, you know, practically the way the things that I do, the calculations that I do, it plays absolutely no role. I also don't think that it has much of an influence on, you know, the more philosophical questions that I've been asking, that I've been writing about, that I've been discussing. But I have noticed a few times that when I talk to scientists, physicists mostly, admittedly, who are openly religious, as opposed to those who would describe themselves as atheists, then the religious ones are the ones who are more careful about distinguishing between their belief-based interests and their metaphysical assumptions and so on, than the ones who kind of think they're above it, right? Because they're not religious. So that's just, you know, an observation that I have made. But I guess to what Luke just said, I would say probably the predictable thing, if you say there's something remarkable about it, there's something rare about it, I would say that these are just things that you can't quantify. It's not a scientific statement. I have no doubt that you feel about it this way, and probably a lot of people do it, but I wouldn't know how to phrase it scientifically, and that's something that I just can't work with. I also, especially this issue about the rarity, I would have no idea how to even quantify something like this. Like, if you say, well, you know, the universe could have been anyway, but let's just assume that it can be described by mathematics, just so we have some place to start with. Then you have what Max Tegmark called the mathematical universe. You know, there are all these possible mathematical structures. And the ones that we observe to describe our universe is an infinitesimally small part of that. So, and how much do you know about how likely something like life, which we can't even agree on what it is anywhere in this mathematical universe? We have absolutely no idea. I'm not even sure that that's a question to which the answer can even be quantified. So it's just something that I can't make any sense of.
I mean, one of the phrases Luke used earlier, which I thought was quite interesting, was the question is whether you think there are good questions outside of science, in a way. And now you've said that obviously for your research, you don't need to be asking anything other than purely scientific questions. And that's totally understandable. But are you interested yourself in questions beyond science? I mean, is it a valid question to be asking in the first place? You know, is there something beyond the universe that explains the universe? Or do you think that the only kinds of questions we should be asking are those purely scientific questions?
Well, I do have non-scientific questions, like, for example, how do I fill in my stupid tax forms? Right? I mean, and certainly there are more philosophical questions that I'm interested in, though I have to admit that's mostly to the extent that I think maybe one day they might become scientific questions. So I'm afraid I'm very much the scientist. So yeah, maybe since I know we're nearing the end, maybe that's a point worth emphasizing. There have certainly been scientific philosophical questions in the past that at some point turned into scientific questions. Like the cosmological principle, for example, since we're already talking about cosmology, that's something that scientists have found a way to approach, actually ask the question, you know, how uniformly distributed is matter, stars, galaxies actually in the universe, is something that was once considered to be a philosophical principle. And now we have, you know, a lot of this research about consciousness. That's something which was not too long time ago in the field of philosophy, but now it's more and more turning into a scientific discipline. And maybe there are other areas where this will also happen.
What about you, Luke? Do you approve of the overlap? Do you think you have to go get philosophical at some point when you, I suppose, reach the boundaries of what science can tell you?
I think, for me, the difference between science and philosophy is what it's trying to understand rather than any... I think there is, epistemology, the theory of how we know things, how we know anything. I think once you've got a firm epistemology, you can then aim that to try and understand the world and in terms of the world, and that's science. Or if there's a hypothesis which is not about the physical world around us, we could aim our the same epistemology, asking good questions and logic and pulling together the information we have and Bayesian probabilities and all that sort of stuff. And we can aim them at those questions as well. And so for me, it's not that. I disagree that science becomes philosophy, but never mind that. That might just be worrying about words. But if for me, there's sort of a coherent, an integrated whole there. It's not that, saying a question is unscientific is just to say what it's aimed at trying to understand rather than any sort of, rejection of that idea. It's not a put down. There are questions that try to be scientific but fail. So unfalsifiable scientific theories, but that's another issue.
Sure. It's been really interesting having you both on to discuss these questions. I suppose I'd be interested, just as we begin to wrap things up, Sabina, you've said, from the outset that the kind of the God question just doesn't particularly interest you. You're interested in the science and you don't think the science could ever provide any kind of evidence for the God question. That's a kind of separate sphere, I suppose, the non-overlapping magisteria, as some philosophers and scientists have put it. But obviously, as I said at the beginning, you are a multifaceted person. You enjoy the singing, you enjoy, the relationships and everything else. And when I looked at some of your videos, they are, in a sense, asking big questions about life and love and meaning and purpose and that kind of thing. So in that sense, it strikes me, you go beyond the science in some areas of your life. You do sort of, in a sense, those kinds of questions, presumably, you don't think have scientific answers. When you put a video together, a music video, you're not particularly necessarily just thinking about how will, what is the scientific aspect of this. You're looking to engage someone emotionally and everything else in that. So in that sense, I'm just interested to know, do you think there's a different part of your personality that would be open to the God question? Or do you think that's a sort of, you just don't have to go there in that sense?
Oh, well, I'm certainly open to the God question. I just don't really see that there's any interesting information coming in anytime soon, I guess. I've been a little confused by what you just said about, will science ever provide evidence for God or something like this? So I guess if that happened, then I would no longer consider it to be a religious God. So I guess I kind of really think of these things as two non-overlapping areas. Does that suffice as an explanation?
No, I understand what you're saying. I suppose what you're saying is if someone did present some scientific evidence for God, then it wouldn't be the God as you understand God to be defined, because it would become part of the natural world. It would become something you could, physically sort of investigate. That's a very fair point. I suppose what I would be interested to know is, if could you imagine what sort of type of evidence it would be then, if it's not scientific, if it was something else that would draw you towards that belief? I mean, I'm asking you a hypothetical here, obviously, but could you imagine what sort of thing you would need to entertain the idea, at least, that there's a God behind everything?
Not really, no. I can't think of anything.
You don't know what that would be. Well, that's fair enough, because, you know, I suppose most of the time we don't know what something is until it's presented to us as in that way. Luke, do you think people kind of have to start out with a religious inclination to see fine-tuning as potentially evidence for God? Or, I mean, you were co-authored this book with your atheist colleague, Geraint Lewis. I'm just wondering, you know, when we come to these questions, whether the worldview we bring with us inevitably informs the way we're going to interpret the evidence. And, you know, you did come to this question as a Christian. And so is it natural then to say, well, of course, you're going to say, you know, there's a potential divine explanation for this, whereas an atheist like Geraint and indeed Sabina is going to say, no, I don't think we need to go in that direction.
Well, I love, there's a story told by Alistair McGrath who said he'd given a presentation which involved just discussing the basics of fine tuning as I presented them before, and someone in the audience talked to him afterwards and said, it's one of my favorite quotes about fine tuning, actually, I'm not religious, but something weird is going on here. I think you know, Hoyle's point that, you know, he was an atheist and yet this sort of took him aback a bit does say that there is something there. Now, maybe after all said and done, you know, that initial reaction you then analyze, and when Sabina does that, she doesn't see the numbers she needs, so no further. I think you can get the, I've got a paper in a philosophical journal called A Reasonable Little Question, if you want to see my attempts to put some numbers on it. Maybe it's not convincing. But I do think, you know, you try not to just... Confirmation bias is one... It is really hard to avoid. It's really hard not to just read all the books that you agree with already and just have a wonderful time agreeing with all these people who already agree with you. And so I think fine-tuning, you know, it does fit into my worldview nicely. I think it doesn't fit into naturalism, but that's a point of contention. But I think, I mean, just the important thing for me that I keep trying to do is to read not only people who are atheists or who don't believe in God or agnostics who criticize fine-tuning, but the ones who then point out the stuff about our universe which doesn't look so nice and wonderful and lovely, like evil and suffering and all that sort of stuff. So I think, fine-tuning, whatever it is, it's only one piece of the puzzle. It might be a very small piece as we try to think through these big issues. So for me, it's been, you know, I had a policy last year that for every two audiobooks, every three audiobooks, one of them I had to disagree with from the start that I read through. And I've been trying to do that. It was a very challenging year. But I think that's what you've got to try and do.
Well, either way, it's been great having you both on the show. And Sabina, I guess ultimately, even though you obviously don't see any evidence for God or from the science and so on, you're still, as you said at the outset, you find the fact that we can be sitting here discussing these ideas, you know, doing particle physics, pretty amazing in and of itself. That at least perhaps we can all agree on. Well, look, it's been wonderful having you both on the show. Thank you very much for taking the time. And I will make sure there are links with today's program where people can find out more about you. But for now, Luke and Sabina, thanks for being with me today.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's show. And if you want to respond via email to me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the place to do it. Or you can do it on our social media too, @unbelievablejb for Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page of the show. I'm also on Instagram and TikTok as justin.brierley. But I'd love you to also respond via our survey. Tell us what you thought of today's show. It's multi-choice and really quick. So do head over to the info with today's podcast and you can simply click through and leave your thoughts that way as well. I'd love to see what you made of today's show. And don't forget, you can sign up for more from The Big Conversation at thebigconversation.show. And I'm going to be bringing you the results from the last two surveys of our last two big conversations in just a moment's time. Now, those who enjoyed Luke Barnes on today's show might be interested in the fact that the Unbelievable Skeptic and Discussion Group that normally meets in London have actually been meeting online over the past year. And this Monday, the 7th of June, Luke Barnes will be speaking to them, and there'll be an opportunity to discuss his talk as part of that. He's talking about the argument from design, fine-tuning, and you can find out more at meetup.com. You're looking for the Unbelievable Skeptic and Discussion Group. It is all online at the moment, so you can actually join from anywhere in the world. But it's taking place this Monday, the 7th of June. Okay, let's look at some of the results from the survey that have been taken on the last two big conversation episodes. So a few weeks ago, we had our episode 2, AI, the Future and God Were Being Debated by Rosalind Picard and Nick Bostrom. Now, the majority of those responding were Christians, but about a quarter actually responding were atheist, agnostic, or of another worldview as well. And when it came to who were you more persuaded by, Rosalind Picard or Nick Bostrom, overall 55% said they were more persuaded by Rosalind Picard, 9% more persuaded by Nick Bostrom, 36% equally persuaded by both or not persuaded by either, responding in that kind of category. But if you just sort of do it just for atheists and agnostics, if you like, just accounting for those, a higher percentage siding with Nick Bostrom and equally a higher percentage with Ross when broken down for Christians. So perhaps as you may expect, given that Ros was our Christian participant and Nick our non-Christian participant, we asked, did the conversation make the prospect of AI consciousness seem more or less likely to you? AI consciousness being this idea that, you know, one day AI computers will ultimately become thinking, feeling beings. 64% it didn't change their view, 64%. 29% said they felt it was less likely after listening to the conversation. 7% said they felt it was more likely. And that wasn't actually affected much by whether people said they were Christian or not in the survey. We asked whether the conversation made it feel more plausible to you that we could be living in a simulation universe. Was that more or less likely? That was a really interesting part of their conversation. 62% said it didn't change their view, though we don't know exactly which view they had to start with. 25% said it made it seem less plausible that we're living in a simulation universe. And 13% said they felt it was actually more plausible that we might be living in a simulation universe. On this one, those registering atheist or agnostic were more likely to find it more plausible that we were living in a simulation universe. Christians, less plausible. So there are some of the results from that AI conversation. And by the way, there's a great interview with Rosalind Picard in the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. It's with Ruth. It's about her her life, her faith, her work in technology. And we linked to that in our social media over the last week or so and on our newsletter as well. But if you want to get hold of that, you can just check out our social media and, of course, subscribe to the newsletter as well from our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Identity, myth and miracle. Do we need a story to live by in a post-Christian world was our rather grand title for episode 3 of the big conversation. Here's what you said in response when it came to the survey we put out there. Who were you most persuaded by, Douglas Murray or N.T. Wright? Well, interestingly on this one, most respondents saying equally persuaded by both. And perhaps that's explicable by the fact there was a lot of common ground between N.T. Wright and Douglas Murray in that particular conversation. We also asked, were you more or less persuaded in the conversation that Christianity is important to our cultural identity? Well, the vast majority saying more persuaded, and second place to it didn't change their view. Only a tiny number reported being less persuaded that Christianity is important to our cultural identity. Again, perhaps unsurprising given that there was common ground shared on that particular issue between Douglas Murray and N.T. Wright. Now, the area where they obviously had a difference was whether the story of Christianity is actually true. And so we asked the question, did the conversation lead you to be more or less persuaded that the story of Christianity is true? Over half said it didn't change their mind. Again, probably you can assume most of those respondents already believe it to be true. But everyone else responded that it persuaded them it was more true. In fact, no one out of all the respondents said that they felt it was less true on the back of listening to the conversation. So there you go. So some of the results from the last two episodes of The Big Conversation. And in both cases, regardless of whether the conversation changed people's minds, the vast majority of respondents said it had helped them to understand other people's points of views on these subjects better, which is really what this show is about, you know, creating better conversations, understanding each other more. And of course, sometimes people get persuaded along the way. So, yeah, if you're able to fill out the latest survey, we'd appreciate that. We love seeing how these conversations affect people. And you can do that again from the link in the podcast information with today's show. And again, thebigconversation.show is the place to go if you want more from The Big Conversation, further episodes, bonus content, and the regular newsletter as well. Well, we'll have some of your feedback to recent shows on next week's program, but thank you very much for being with me on today's edition of the show. Looking forward to a summer of science. That's what we've got lined up for you in the rest of June. Let me tell you what's coming up soon. Yes, we're calling it the summer of science because while we heard about fine-tuning today, and next week we're talking about the origins of the universe, especially in the case for God. Well-known intelligent design advocate Stephen C. Meyer is author of a new book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. It lays out three areas of science where Stephen believes the God hypothesis has come back steaming ahead, actually, in the last few decades. Well, we'll be talking specifically about the origins of the universe in conversation with University of California physics professor Brian Keating on next week's show. And then we've got further shows debating intelligent design in biology. Gunter Beckley and Joshua Swamidas due to join me. And another great big conversation on the origins of life between Paul Davies and Jeremy England. Lots to look forward to on Unbelievable. Thanks for being with us this time, and see you next week.